This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We are the 99%. In less than a year, that phrase and its implied meaning has become apparent to most every American. Now, that does not mean, however, that all Americans agree with what has become known as the Occupy movement, or even that most of us know exactly what Occupy protesters are really after. So today, we talk with representatives of two of the most active Occupy demonstrations in our region, Occupy Charlottesville and Occupy Harrisonburg. What do you most want to know about the Occupy agenda? Who do you think the movement represents? How do you think it should proceed from here? Your participation is certainly welcome this hour as we delve deep into Virginia's version of Occupy right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The Occupy movement in the Commonwealth is our focus this hour. If you've got a question about it or an opinion on it, we are hoping to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Michael Fikema is a former college professor from South Dakota who moved to Virginia last year and is now active with a group that calls itself Occupy Harrisonburg. And David Swanson, former Virginia-based newspaper reporter, now a freelance writer, has been an activist with Occupy Charlottesville and Occupy Washington, D.C. Thank you both for making time for us.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to be here, too.
Well, Michael, you first, if I could. What do you think the Occupy movement is really about?
Well, I think the Occupy movement is smart enough to know what it's about, and it showed that by the kind of slogans and message that it communicated, and the central message that it communicated is that America has reached levels of intolerable and self-destructive inequality, both in terms of economic inequality and in terms of political inequality. And I think that's at the core. And I think it was a powerful message that had not managed to surface before that time. And they succeeded in changing the national conversation, which had become entirely focused upon the federal deficit and who was going to be the best at cutting the federal deficit and imposing essentially austerity on the population so they could pay for the consequences of the economic crisis. So, I think that's the central message, and it wouldn't have been able to do that if it hadn't resonated with incredible power in the American population. And I think it's sort of an explosion because it's a delayed thing that's been building up, not just for the time since the economic crisis, but for throughout our entire history, it's built up. And especially in the recent decades, the 3 to 4 decades that we've been involved in where we've had the Wall Street model imposed on us, this has been something that's been happening, but people haven't been able to talk about it. And finally, with Occupy, they found a movement that gave voice to the thing that they had been feeling and experiencing, which was the pain and suffering connected with inequality, because that's what it has to do with.
I agree. Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think there is growing inequality of wealth, of power, of decision-making ability in our public sphere, of who is subject to the rule of law and who has immunity and can keep quiet and protected their crimes. And I think that there is frustration with the tactics as usual, that letters to the editor and calls to Congress and marches that the TV stations ignore weren't doing it. And so, you know, when Tahrir Square happened in Cairo, when Madison happened in Wisconsin, and all last spring and summer, it was in the air. There were a half dozen major initiatives to start this kind of thing happening. One was one that I was part of to start Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. on October 6th, the 10-year mark in Afghanistan. And just before that, Occupy Wall Street really took off, ironically enough, by getting its way into the corporate media for any number of reasons, including novelty and dumb mayors and brutal police. But it had an incredible resonance and a message that was brilliantly inclusive of 99% of the people.
It seems to me that both of you have a strong feeling that the Occupy movement has been either uncovered, excuse me,
gotten very low coverage or distorted coverage from the news media in general. Am I right with that impression?
Well, I don't know. I think the thing that was most striking to me initially was that it got the coverage it got at all, because there have been incredible demonstrations that have taken place that the mass media has just ignored. And so for me, this was a breakthrough in respect to that. And I kind of wonder, you know, how that happened and why it happened. And there may be a lot of reasons, but I think that we are in a situation. This crisis is so deep. The economic crisis is so deep and so profound. When you're in a crisis like that, frequently the elite begins to divide over how to deal with the crisis. And I think that there is a division over how to deal with this crisis. And the main response that we've seen has been to impose austerity, and that has tended to be the dominant one, and to make the population pay for the cost of the crisis, and to use as an opportunity to privatize everything in sight, to destroy unions forever, to undermine the social welfare state and gains that the social safety net. You know, that's one kind of hard-nosed conservative approach to the crisis. But I also think that there are people who are very much part of the elite that realize that this is economically irrational and self-destructive, that it's not going to deal with the underlying problem, and that there is a need for a policy that stimulates demand and that that acts upon the lessons that were learned from the Great Depression. But they haven't had a social movement to give them weight to rein in the self-destructive ideologues that have so far dominated the response.
But my question, Michael, had to do with news media coverage. Am I wrong in my impression that you and David think that news media coverage has not been fair or has largely missed some of the fundamental points of what's going on?
Well, I think at first it was almost amusing, their befuddlement in respect to by saying that, well, they have no concrete demands. What are they talking about? You know, and so on. And I think that the problem was that we're really dealing with whole frameworks of thought.
Well, wait a minute. Was that unfair that when it started, and it started, last September or into early October, with a small encampment that called itself Occupy Wall Street, made up largely of young people, and when asked what they wanted, what their agenda was, it seemed that they all either had no coherent answer or completely different answers. Was it unfair for the national news media to be reporting that impression at that time?
It's not so much. I really wouldn't even put it in moral terms, in terms of fairness. I actually think they didn't comprehend Occupy. And the reason is
that... Well, what was there to comprehend? You got a small protest going on near Wall Street with people saying, we're fed up, but I'm not sure what they were saying they were fed up about. No, David, please do join
me. Might I throw a word in here? You go to any crowd, you approach people, you will find people who with every opinion under the sun. And there was selective reporting. There was a choice to go with those protesters who looked confused and befuddled, and to go with those who, for their own misguided principles, wanted to not have concrete demands. But you try to find me a concrete demand in the Democratic Party platform or the Republican Party platform. And then you go and look at October2011.org, which we had up for 6 months before we occupied Washington, D.C., and you will see a list of specific concrete demands spelled out in great detail. You go to Wall Street with a protest of a concentration of people who have trashed the economy and been bailed out against the passionate opinion of 90% of Americans.
David, you and Michael both have really strong opinions, but I'm trying to narrow in here on the degree to which the people listening right now have an accurate idea of what the Occupy movement is, of how it started, of how it evolved. And what I heard from both of you before the microphones got turned on today and in other conversations we've had is that you think people have been disserved because the media has misrepresented it. So let's go back to the beginning, when NPR was the first national American news organization to cover the Occupy movement going on in Wall Street, when it started very small. The first international news organization that I'm aware of a couple days before NPR picked it up was actually Al Jazeera. And then shortly after NPR began covering it, other media did. But also after that coverage of Wall Street started, then it seems to me that other Occupy movements began to appear across the country. But do I have that timeline wrong?
No, no, you do not, except that you write Democracy Now! And Pacifica and all sorts of fine media institutions out of existence through your telling of history, just as the American people feel like they've been written out of the picture in how our government runs and how our major media outlets talk about it. We have debates between whether to bail out the bankers for this enormous amount or that enormous amount when 90% of the people are against bailing them out at all. We feel shut out. And so you take a protest to Wall Street, where this is what's just happened, and you write posters with clear messages about how Wall Street got bailed out and we got sold out and we want a say in our government and we want money invested in human needs, not wars and billionaires. And then you have reporters come asking, what is your specific demand? What bill would you like passed? Who are you going to back in the next election? Are you serious or not? Because voting is the only thing you can do, to people who have discovered that there is something much more powerful they can do than voting, than rallying, than writing letters, and you're going to get a miscommunication between those two parties.
I think that what you're talking about here is that people are talking about the complete failure of the entire system, the economy and the political system, and that one of the functions of the political system and the economy is to bring people together in a productive and a way that serves the common good. That's supposed to be the purpose of the economy and the political system, and both of them are miserable systemic failures. So what they're doing is not just talking about that. They're initiating a new process of deeper democracy in which we begin talking to each other about real issues and begin to, by doing that, form a consensus about what we should do in our society and with the economy and the political system. And so one of the most powerful things that Occupy Wall Street has done is to get that process going, so that people are now on their own, spontaneously meeting and discussing and thinking and, I think, working towards a consensus. So you don't want to jump the gun before you start the national conversation about what the problems are and what we should do. You shouldn't jump the gun and say, here's what we should do. No, you should let that process work. And the amazing thing was that it didn't stay in New York City. It exploded in solidarity demonstrations across the entire country in every large city and every tiny little hamlet, people, you know, with 10 people in it. And stuff
give
like that.
Tom he's yeah. got a point.
To you on the other side of your radio, mm-hmm. How did you first hear about the Occupy movement? What was your first blush impression? And has that impression changed at all over the ensuing months? 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825 to join our conversation by phone. Or you can post to us on the Virginia Insight Facebook page. And we have this post coming in from Russ. Do you think the Occupy of Wall Street works on Main Street? And will it matter at all if you don't vote? David?
I think it matters a lot more than voting. I think voting is important and it's needed. But one of the central, clearest as a bell demands from the beginning of these encampments has been to clean up the election system so that voting can become meaningful, get the money out of it, get decent media coverage, get free airtime, get rid of the bribery and the open outside corporate spending and the ballot access rules and the two-party domination. Open it up to candidates, have the votes verifiably counted publicly before witnesses at each polling place and so forth. And these demands are not hard to find from the Occupy movement. But, you know, as Emma Goldman said, if voting it by itself changed anything, they'd ban it. Right. You know, voting is what we do for 30 seconds every 2 years. It's what you do in between there. It's what you do to pressure your government as a whole on behalf of the people as a whole that is much more powerful. We just had a Dr. King holiday. He never got accused of not being serious because he wouldn't back a candidate, because he wouldn't put everything into elections, because he wouldn't give all his resources to some political party. He said, no, we got civil rights by organizing as people against a government that was not representing us.
David Swanson, who was active with Occupy Charlottesville and continues to be active with Occupy Washington, D.C., is one of our guests. Sitting next to him, Michael Fikema from Occupy Harrisonburg. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got some calls coming in we're going to get to right after the break. Tom Petty way back in 1989, promising he wouldn't back down. How do you feel about the Occupy movement? Our call-in phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK, 1-888-967-2825. Our guests from the group Occupy Harrisonburg, former history and religion professor Michael Fikema, and formerly affiliated with the group Occupy Charlottesville, freelance writer David Swanson. First call coming in from Harrisonburg. Tom, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I live in Charlottesville, and I'm in Harrisonburg at the moment. But I remember months before Occupy started in September, posing the question to friends about whether it was possible to remove money from politics. And it was almost across the board, no. Everybody was very pessimistic about that. And I found it remarkable that by September, that had changed. People were giving that a try as far as speaking about it and thinking about how that might be done. And then there was a book out by Lawrence Lessig about his idea, an economist from Harvard, I believe. And other things I noticed were just the community spirit surrounding the movement reflected to me more about Christian values than you normally see in the general, the way people refer to the country as a Christian nation, whether that's another debate, I suppose, but the people who speak of that often don't seem to include clear like actions that would support the poor. And that seemed to be happening during these gatherings in the General Assembly.
Tom, let me interrupt. The person's voice that you may have heard say mm-hmm a couple of times is Michael Fikema, so I'm going to ask him to join in with his thoughts.
Well, I think you're bringing up a really key point in respect to Occupy. And I think that I said earlier inequality is a central theme, but I think you could say just as well love or compassion, because the opposite of inequality is actually love, inclusiveness, where everyone is included. And he's right to put his finger on the fact that that is the central theme of the Christian tradition, but not just the Christian tradition, the biblical tradition, and many other faith traditions. And what Occupy is doing, and this is why it wasn't understood by the media at first, and I was trying to make this point, is that it's shifting the ground, the categories with which we look at the economy, and it is injecting moral and spiritual qualities and categories into the way that we judge the economy. And that is a revolution, because what we've had is mostly technical categories in respect to the economy. You know, how fast is it growing? What's the size of the GDP? How's the Dow Jones Industrial Index doing today? These are all technical, mathematical kinds of categories. And to re-inject moral and spiritual categories into the discussion about the economy is a revolution. It's going back, in some senses, to the way in which economies were at least legitimated in the past, in the Middle Ages, where harsh economic practices were considered to be a violation, a mortal sin, a violation of Christian teaching. And you were considered to have to love your neighbor not only in the private sphere, but in the public sphere as well, in your economic relations. And I think we're going back to that. And
Tom, thank you so much for your call. Phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. We are getting lots of calls, but we have one line open at the moment. So if you've been trying to get through and got a busy signal, this would be a good time to call back at 888-967-2825. Next to Lynchburg Justice, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment.
Call.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my comment about the Occupy movement, and I think the speaker, I'm sorry to catch your name, but you very eloquently just kind of gave some sort of a focus to the Occupy movement. But I feel that that has been something that has been largely missing, and that maybe now, much later after its starting of the movement, that we found people trying to give a real focus for it. But I've spoken to someone who was in the Occupy Oakland movement. I have a couple of friends who went to one in Virginia. And generally speaking, when I talk to different people, everyone has a different reason for the movement. That's been my experience. And I feel like it really lacked a lot of focus, kind of like the Republican Party right now, if you will. You know, there doesn't seem to be a coherent message that has grounded everyone together.
Now, David Swanson, let me follow up with David Swanson about this, because, David, you mentioned a few minutes ago about how much different the approach was to the message that Martin Luther King Jr. had. But there was no question when he was leading demonstrations that he was talking about the need for civil rights, for the Jim Crow laws and the other discrimination against blacks to end. There certainly, as Justice, I think, is pointing out, wasn't that kind of coherent message at the beginning of the Occupy movement.
And there wasn't in the historical Martin Luther King, who was opposing wars and taking positions on foreign affairs and on domestic affairs right and left, and who cannot be.
But that isn't where he started. He started with a message about we need to stop treating blacks as second, fourth, fifth, or sixth class citizens.
Right.
Is it possible that what Justice is saying is that although the movement started out with no coherent message, that now, as right. Michael is saying, the message is coalescing around inequality?
You can describe it as a demand for greater equality, for representative government. You can summarize it in any number of ways. But when Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence and he had 25 complaints against King George in there, nobody demanded that it be shrunk down to a size that would fit in a soundbite on CNN. And if it didn't, it wasn't serious and it wasn't good messaging. It's not our fault that our government is entirely broken. It's not our fault that we have a problem of over-militarization, of attacks on the safety net, of environmental destruction, of lacks of civil liberties, of assaults on rights to organize, on inequality in administration of the rule of law. These are all a function of the lack of representative government, of the rule of a plutocratic, abusive elite. Mm-hmm. But there are lots of complaints, and some complaints motivate certain individuals more than others, and so they will talk about those more than others. And so the movement is developing. It's developing a campaign to target student debt and removing that. It's developing a very powerful campaign to go after these underwater mortgages and these mortgage abuses. It's developing a campaign to go after election spending. We have two states, Hawaii and New Mexico. State legislatures have now demanded a constitutional amendment to get the money out. We need 36 more states. This is how you start a movement. But there are a lot of branches, and they're all part of the same tree.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to refer to something that was produced by Occupy Harrisonburg, which is the Occupy Harrisonburg, Virginia Declaration. And so that would represent something that we as a group did, not just my own individual perspectives. And I think that speaks to what we're talking about. We believe that government can secure our rights only if it derives its just powers from the consent of the people. But no true democracy is possible when the exercise of that power is determined by money. We believe that when money systematically nullifies the will of the people, ours is no longer a government for the people. It is therefore our duty to alter it. Just as our ancestors threw off the tyranny of government by monarchy in order to establish a democracy, we today must throw off the tyranny of government by money in order to reclaim our democracy. To me, money and the power to create and allocate money is at the heart of what Occupy Wall Street is about. And when you put it in that way, it directly connects it to all kinds of very specific proposals for structural and institutional changes that could be made in order to address this problem.
Justice, thank you so much for your call. Next to Afton, Chris, you're on Virginia Insight. Thanks for calling us at 888-WMRA Talk. Your question or comment for David Swanson and or Michael Fikema, please.
Yeah, I was just wondering how the people that want the most are doing the least to accomplish anything, and how sitting in parks is really going to produce anything. And I like the comparison with the civil rights movement, except you're sitting in parks now, and with the sit-ins then, it was visualized their rights being violated, and the same thing's happening to the Occupy movement now, and legislation's just being passed to support it.
Is there a question in there, Chris?
How is anything going to be accomplished when we're just sitting in parks?
Well, I'm not sure anything is going to be accomplished with just sitting in parks. When we started sitting in parks in Washington, D.C. back in October, we also began every day multiple nonviolent actions, shutting down the arms of Wall Street in Washington, the arms of the war machine in Washington, weapons manufacturers. I'm on probation now. I cannot go to Capitol Hill because I spoke as a member of the public in a public hearing in which our Congress and President were ramming through three new NAFTA-like treaties with three new countries and openly talking about the fact that they would have to mitigate the damage they were causing.
Wait a minute. You didn't get told that you had to stay away from D.C. for 6 months simply because you spoke.
Yes, I did. You are not allowed to speak in a Senate committee hearing unless the chairman...
So what you were charged with was interrupting the procedures of a committee hearing. It wasn't like because you went to a friend's house and you spoke your opinion. You were in sort of the equivalent of a judicial hearing, and the judicial hearing ruled you out of order. That's a little bit, to be fair, David, different than saying, I have a criminal record now because I spoke my opinion.
It is, and it can get even more specific than that. Here was a room with 80% of the seats taken by corporate lobbyists and them sitting silently while their money was doing the talking. And the senators were saying everything they wanted to hear. And a handful of seats left for the public in what they call a public hearing, but absolutely no opportunity for any member of the public to speak with permission. So you spoke by interrupting or not at all. And so that was my choice. But I think that when you see people come together in a park and talk to each other and organize and strategize and come up with what their specific campaigns are going to be, and we've been seeing that process develop, and you see them resist nonviolently the crackdown on their rights to gather together in that park. We have a First Amendment right to petition our government for a redress of grievances. Our government is thousands of miles away from most people's homes. Most people can't afford $400 a night for a hotel in downtown Washington, D.C. So if you cannot gather in tents in a park, you cannot exercise that right except through phone calls and emails, which are ignored. So we're trying to exercise our right, and they're trying to kick us out. Well, when they told the people in Freedom Plaza, you are going to have to be out by midnight on this date, we threw a party, we invited the world, we brought in bands, we played music, we danced, we energized each other, and the Park Service came and said, you know what, rather than having to get out tonight, we think you have to have a permit and we're going to give you a permit for 4 more months. And the power that people who had been completely helpless and powerless and defeatist felt that next day as they put in plans and meetings and actions to try to make this world a better place shows you where hope comes from, where the possibility of change comes from, where the possibility of taking money out of the elections becomes real. And you can't do that if you can't gather together face-to-face in public space.
Michael Feichemann?
Yeah.
Response to Justin's...
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I just want to talk about some of the things that Occupy Harrisonburg has been doing besides talking, which is also, I think, very important. And I think
Chris's question was, what do you accomplish by sitting in parks?
Well, there are things you can accomplish by sitting in parks because you have to reflect in order to act, and you have to have both, and you can't just go acting without thinking. So the sitting in parks is in order to come together and to be able to think and plan actions. And one of the things that we have focused on is to look around us and see where a new economy and a new Main Street-based economy is already being built and has been being built for many decades. And in fact, there are roots that go long much further back than that. And if you look in Harrisonburg, you can find that. And we members of our group have been participating in something called the the New Community Project, which is a project in building sustainable living and renovating a house and doing carpentry and gardening in order to try and start modeling and creating the kind of society that we need to move towards. We've also focused on moving your money to encourage people to take their money out of the big Wall Street banks and put it into credit unions and community banks, which are existing institutions. I mean, Wall Street destroyed a financial system that at one time was oriented towards the communities and was oriented towards the real economy, towards productive investment. And they, with their financial modernization, destroyed that. We need to go back to that, but we need to go deeper. And we need to have a new economy that is focused around some of the things that have been developing, like cooperatives, like worker-owned enterprises, and create a broader financial system that will be oriented towards serving those kinds of developments. Because that's the kind of economy that would be close to the people and would be rooted in communities and rooted in nature. And we want to focus on building those things that are already there. So it's very important people to look at their own communities and on Main Street and support what's already there and try to build on it. And that's what we've tried to do.
Chris, thanks so much for your call. David Swanson, who's been active with Occupy Charlottesville, and Michael Fikema, who's been active with Occupy Harrisonburg, are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you have thoughts about the Occupy movement or questions about it, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. Or you can post on our Virginia Insight Facebook page, which on Facebook is listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Next to Harrisonburg, Hugh, thank you for joining us. Your question, your comment, please.
Hi, two comments. Lived in Washington State for about 10 years. And at the state level, it was very—I won't say easy, but it was possible to for people to put together petition drives for referendums. Mm-hmm. And almost every election cycle, there were more referendums on the ballot than people. So it felt much more like a democracy because there were local, citywide, countywide, and statewide referendums that happened all the time, and it felt much better than here. I've never seen a referendum on the ballot here. That's just a comment. Would like to hear more about corporate involvement in politics. Have a personal experience with being bullied by a extremely large corporation. And I just feel like Citizens United, that was a deplorable decision by the Supreme Court. And that's probably the main, in my mind, that's one of the main problems that we're dealing with as a society.
Hugh, we have to pause. Well, wait, if you would, we have to pause for a break, but the break is only a minute long. So if you can hold on to the line, I wouldn't be surprised if our guests want some detail about your comment that you were bullied by a big corporation, as well as respond to the comments that they've heard from you. So we're going to do that. We're going to invite our audience that hasn't yet called us to do so at 888-WMRA-TALK. And this conversation about the Occupy movement will continue in just about a minute.
No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of men.
You may recognize the lyrics. Yes, it is the song Imagine, as penned originally by John Lennon, but a modern-day version from the cast of Glee, talking about a different idea of why people get involved in protest movements. Have you ever been involved in a protest movement, or has anybody you know ever been involved in one? And how does that experience of your past compare to what you see going on in the Occupy movement today? We have David Swanson, freelance writer who's been active with Occupy Charlottesville and Occupy Washington, D.C., as one of our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight. Sitting next to him, Michael Fikema, who's active with Occupy Harrisonburg, also a former college professor in South Dakota before he moved to Virginia, where he taught history and religion. Our call-in phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. Hugh is still on the line. His questions had to do with ballot initiatives and corporate power.
Well, I think he's right on target with where he's headed, and I think that it is absolutely the case that we have more representation, more power at the local level, a little bit less at the state level, and radically less at the federal level. The good news is that 38 states
can... Isn't that the same thing the Tea Party is asking for?
The Tea Party has a very different agenda, but they are frustrated with the lack of representation in our federal government.
Saying that the power needs to be transferred to the states and to the local governments.
They are saying that, and to some extent I am saying that, but that's not what I was trying to say there. What I was trying to say is that there is less money involved, there is less corruption, there is more honest representation, greater democratic power now existing at the local level, and more at this and less at the state, and much less at the federal. So the good news is that 38 states can fix the Constitution, can completely rewrite the Constitution without Congress, without the federal government having a say in the matter whatsoever, and can go ahead and not just say that speech is speech and people are people, but also say that we are going to have a public referendum power. We're going to have direct legislation by the people, as other nations have been doing with their rewrites of their constitutions, which, you know, we have barely touched in 2.25 centuries.
Hugh, on the line with us from Harrisonburg, if it's not too personal a question, can you tell us a little bit about what you meant about having been bullied by a huge corporation?
Well, I'll be fairly ambiguous for several reasons, but did a fairly large renewable energy project. One of the investor-owned utilities claimed that we didn't have the right to do it, even though numerous lawyers said that they were basically fabricating ambiguity. And because they were able to create a delay and because they created a situation where we did not have the money or the time to sit around and wait for it to go through the court system, even though nobody involved thinks they were right, they got their way just because they had enough money to push us around. I mean, I literally have an email from the State Corporation Commission saying that they felt they had no basis for what they were doing, but they still got what they wanted just because they had the power.
That's something that you've been saying, Michael, is that the power is way out of whack. Other than saying and getting lots of people saying that's the situation, what's your solution?
Well, I mean, I think in respect to corporations, I think that people have to I think it's good to know the history, the fact that that corporations have not always had that power, that they gained it at a certain point in our history. That the Boston Tea Party was as much a protest against the East India Company as it was against the King of England.
And I understand that you're a former history professor, but in terms of going toward the future, do you have an idea in your mind of how to get it to change?
Yeah, I think that we need to return to a system in which we keep a strong control in relationship to corporations and remember that they are our creatures.
And how do you do that? If, in fact, as you are saying, as David is saying, as I think Hugh is saying, that the system has evolved to a point where corporations with lots of money and individuals with hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in assets are the ones who can have the most influence, the most power, and block other people's rights out. If I understand correctly, that's what you're saying, then other than saying, well, we have to change that, how do you change that?
Well, you have to organize in order to change it. I mean, that's the fundamental thing. There has to be a change in the relationships of power, both between labor and corporations, but also between the population as a whole, which has to struggle and come together, struggle and take the kind of action necessary in order to take back their power. And that involves both legal changes, like a move to amend in terms of changing the rules in respect to corporate personhood in the Constitution, but it also involves on-the-ground organizing and civil disobedience and direct actions and so on directed at reclaiming the power that belongs to us.
So one of the things that you're aiming to do is to get more people involved in protest movements.
Oh, absolutely, and that's crucial, and that's always, I think that's a very difficult dynamic to work with. Occupy has done what it has done partly because of its militancy, but also because its militancy spoke to the great majority of the population. So Occupy is both militant and mainstream. It's hard to hold those together. Sometimes you end up with militancy that loses its connection to the mainstream. And only militancy that is connected to the mainstream can ultimately be effective. And so that's the challenge before Occupy is to do that. And I believe in order to do that, Occupy does have to become really think through and communicate what its overall plans are. Because people do not think that it's hard for people to imagine a system that's not dominated by corporations, just like it was hard for the people in the early modern period to imagine a system that wasn't based on the divine right of kings and aristocracy. There's a failure of imagination that has to be overcome.
Hugh, thanks so much for your call. Another call now from Harrisonburg. This is Robin. Robin, your question or comment for David Swanson and or Michael Fleikema, please.
Yeah, there's a lot of times where I'm in, say, a class or I'm talking with even my family members or old friends, and people talk down about the Occupy movement, saying that it's a bunch of snot-nosed kids who are, you know, waiting for a handout from the government and things like that. And I know personally that's not true, but it's really hard to synthesize an argument against these guys. My question for you all is, what do you end up saying to this kind of criticism?
This is David Swanson.
Well, I say I'm not a kid and there's no snot on my nose, and I'd be happy to come meet your uncle or whoever it is. But that and this is part goes to what Michael was saying about how we become more inclusive and build this movement. We have to be clear. And we have to advance demands that are super majority opinions, as most of them are that we've been advancing here today. And we have to be absolutely committed to nonviolence. We cannot allow our affection for direct democracy to evolve into a sort of consensus where a small minority of people who want to advocate violence allow us as a movement to push diversity of tactics. Because then what happens is when you have provocateurs or police brutality or bad decisions by a handful of people, there's no way to convince the public that it wasn't your movement that did it. And that is repellent to so many people. So we have to be nonviolent and we have to be clear. And the clear demand is power to the people, not the mega international transnational corporations, not the billionaires.
Robin, thanks so much for your call. Yeah. I apologize for cutting you off. We're running a little bit short on time. For anybody who's just joined us, our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight, Michael Fleikema, former professor of history and religion at Mount Mary College in South Dakota, and now an activist with the group Occupy Harrisonburg, and David Swanson, the self-published author of numerous books on political activism, his most recent, The Military-Industrial Complex at 50. It just came out this year. He also has been an activist with Occupy Charlottesville. Our call-in phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. Let's see if we can at least fit in these two calls. We've been waiting for quite a while. Tim in North Garden, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Hi, this question is for David. David, you were with us at the protest against Citizens United in front of the courthouse in downtown Charlottesville about a month ago. And we're also planning a protest on February 29th against Verizon, and specifically against ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, a group of legislators and corporate sponsors rewriting our laws on the state level to benefit corporate interests at the expense of the rest of us. David, I was wondering if you could comment on ALEC and also if this is a good way to speak out against this sort of activity where corporations are just putting loads of money into our government.
Thank you, Tim.
I think it's excellent. I'm looking forward to being there. I'm promoting it. I think everyone should get there, and they can certainly find out about it on davidswanson.org and other sites. I think that, you know, there's a problem of federal law and federal restrictions on what states can even do. We have drone companies writing our laws allowing tens of thousands of drones in our skies. We have these institutions set up to write legislation for the federal government and for the state government.
I'm sorry, I got to ask. Tens of thousands of drones in our skies?
Yes.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about legislation passed last week by the United States Congress. I'm talking about drones rapidly becoming primarily a tool of surveillance rather than bomb dropping. I'm talking about...
Are you saying in the U.S. right now, it is your belief that there are tens of thousands of drones flying over the American people?
Not yet. They have been legally sanctioned for a very short time now. I'm saying that this is the path we are headed to. I'm using this as an example of a bill that was written by the party interested. The industry involved in manufacturing the product writes the legislation word for word. And so we have a serious crisis of corruption at the federal level.
Would you? Because this is the kind of information that I'm sure a number of people in the audience are going to say, I got to see the proof. So if you would send us a link to the bill that you're talking about that you say has passed the U.S. Congress that's going to put tens of thousands of drones in the skies in America, we'll put it a link to it on our Facebook page. Tim, thank you so much. And I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. I think we've got just enough time for this call from Casey in Harrisonburg. Casey, your question or comment, please.
I just had a quick question, whether or not you two thought that the Occupy Wall Street needed a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi type figure to put a face to the movement and kind of centralize the movement.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that, I mean, unfortunately, if you do have a person like that, they can be assassinated, which is what happened to King. And you know, I think that there are so many, it's not a leaderless movement, it's a movement of leaders. There are so many strong voices out there that I don't think you need one voice necessarily. And I think that that when people realize that we can't depend on some leader to save us, that if we're going to be able to change this situation, each one of us is going to have to take responsibility for it and get involved ourselves. And I just think that's a hard realization that people have to act from. And we just don't seem to have any other option before us. So this is what we have to do. And if you look at it in terms of the early church after Jesus died, that's what they did. They lost their leader when he was only 30. But they realized that nothing was going to happen. It wasn't going to continue unless that leader lived in them. And to me, this is the spirit of people like King living on. It's the spirit of people like Gandhi. And so there's a spiritual dimension to this. And I would say that the leadership comes from that spirit. And I think that's powerful enough.
And atheists like myself are invited too. This is 99%. This is not a Christian movement, but I think that was beautifully said. I couldn't possibly agree more.
So in terms of Casey's comment that this movement might be more successful if there was one particular person identified with it, at least for a time, you would disagree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think this is a movement of people power. I think this is democracy developing and enriching itself. And this is the power of people to take their agenda to their local and state and maybe someday federal government and change this country. And it is working. It is educating. It is changing the conversation, changing the polling, passing referenda, passing laws, getting prosecutions begun against banksters. There is success beginning to grow, and it can happen at the state level. These corporations can be dechartered. When the people of West Virginia are sick of Massey Energy treating the lives of miners as a cost of doing business, they can go meet up with the people of Delaware and say, decharter that corporation. Corporations can be ended. We have to take that power back. They are legal creations of us that ought to be under our oversight rather than we serving their interests as if they have more rights, as they legally do now have more rights than we do.
Casey, thank you so much for your call. David Swanson, I've heard you say before that you think one of the keys to the future of the Occupy movement is how it decides to communicate its message, that it cannot depend on the media to do it for them. Tell me a little bit about that, about how you see this movement communicating its message in the future.
Well, I think the breakdown of the corporate media, the lack of a a communication system worthy of a democracy is part of the frustration that has led to this point in the first place. So we have to make use of independent media, our own media, social media. We have to find ways to communicate that are not absolutely dependent, but try to work as well as they can with our television networks and our newspapers. I think that is going to be fundamental going forward.
Yeah, and I think that if you go to Occupy Harrisonburg on the Facebook page of Occupy Harrisonburg, you'll have a good example of how social media can be used in order to build this movement.
Our guests have been David Swanson, longtime political activist, author, and freelance writer, now active with the groups Occupy Charlottesville and Occupy Washington, D.C., as well as Michael Fikema, longtime political activist and former college professor, now active with Occupy Harrisonburg. Thank you both for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. Now, if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about both of our guests. Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Chespe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.